It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looking at how low-level marijuana convictions affect people looking for work and housing in Wisconsin.
First, millions of people lost their homes to foreclosure in the financial collapse roughly a decade ago.
But the story didn't end there. Some people watched the crisis and saw potential.
Before he was president, here's Donald Trump in 2006 speaking in a Trump University audiobook. He was responding to a question about the potential for a real estate market crash.
Well, first of all, I sort of hope that happens because then people like me would go in and buy. You know, if you're in a good cash position, which I'm in a good cash position today, then people like me would go in and buy like crazy.
That was reported by CNN. Trump went on to say he didn't expect that a crash was coming, but then it did.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter with Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's been looking into stories of people devastated by the housing crisis and the men who profited from it, a number of them close to Trump himself.
He's the author of the new book, Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, Aaron, when people tell the story of the Great Recession, I think it's often, okay, we had the mortgage collapse, things went south, and then we've had a gradual recovery. But you tell a story in your book that behind the scenes, something very fundamental changed in the way that homes are owned in America and who owns those. Can you tell that big picture story before we dig into the details?
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting in my house watching the presidential election in 2016. Watching the tremendous rise of Donald Trump, a right-wing populist for president, and at the same time, the rise of Bernie Sanders, a progressive populist running for president. So we have, you know, supposedly economic good times, low unemployment, high Dow Jones industrial average, and yet millions of people on both the left and right are feeling like everything is going terribly, terribly wrong. So I decided to look at home ownership. We had 8 million homes across America that were lost during the Great Recession. About 100,000 of them were in Wisconsin. And those homes didn't just disappear. You know, they ended up being owned by someone. And so when I looked at the data and I saw that the home ownership rate had gone down every year during the Obama administration, it went down in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 and 16 until in 2016, it bottomed out at its lowest rate in more than 50 years. And I asked myself, well, who's benefiting from this? Who's taking the wealth when we're losing it? And the answer was the home wreckers.
We'll meet some of the individual home wreckers in a bit, but talk about the process. How did a group of investors on their own, banks, individuals, you name it, how did they get into this industry of picking up these homes?
Well, they came in a variety of ways. You know, the book is focused on one home in the Los Angeles area because these machinations can get so complicated. But then when you look at it in one home, it becomes quite clear. So Sandy Jolly was the Southern California woman. Her parents had scrimped and saved their whole lives to buy this house just north of the city. You know, you find these kind of homes all over America, 1,500 square feet, little patch of lawn, lemon tree out front. He worked for the water department. She worked for a company that printed business and payroll checks. And at the height of the bubble in 2005, shortly before he died, they signed this predatory reverse mortgage that sapped their wealth. And then when the bubble burst, the bank that made that loan failed. And the guy who came in and bought this failed bank off the government, paying the government $0, was a group led by this guy, Steve Mnuchin, who many may know is now our Treasury Secretary. And the agreement that they made with the government agreed to subsidize their foreclosures. So every time he would foreclose on a family, if he took a loss, we, the government, would pay his losses, including his attorney's fees, appraisal costs, inspection costs. And we end up paying Steve Mnuchin's group more than $1 billion as he forecloses on 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors, just like Sandy Jolly. And then, of course, the house doesn't just disappear after the foreclosure. So Sandy goes to the courthouse. She tries to stop the auction, and the house is sold to an LLC shell company that rents it back to her. And she ends up paying more than $42,000 in rent to rent from the shell company over the next 18 months. And that shell company turns out to be part of this huge real estate empire that owns more than 30,000 homes all over the U.S. And the man behind that real estate empire is Tom Barrack, Donald Trump's best friend, who introduced Ivanka at the convention and planned the inauguration. So that just kind of gives you a flavor of who's involved and how they profited.
Talking to Aaron Glantz about his new book, Home Wreckers, about how some wealthy investors, banks, and others were able to profit from the big foreclosure crisis about 10 years ago. Aaron, we'll dig further into the Trump administration, but you say there's a lot of blame to go around in the initial response to the Great Recession, including what you were just talking about, kind of incentivizing foreclosure with government money.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, people say to me, Aaron, is this an anti-Trump book? And I say, well, you know, I have Steve Mnuchin, this Treasury Secretary, on the cover. He's a foreclosure king. I have Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, on the cover. He's pulling money out of the house. He made a similar deal to the one Mnuchin made, but the bank, failed bank, was in Florida. I've got one of the best friends of the president, Steve Schwarzman, on the cover. You know, his firm now controls 80,000 homes across more than a dozen states. So it used to be, you know, 80,000 families, 80,000 homes. Now one company, 80,000 homes. And then Trump, you know, holding a big wad of cash and say, is this an anti-Trump book? And I say, well, these are the guys who did it. These are the home wreckers. But all of their home wrecking, all of their profiteering was made possible by decisions made during the Obama years. And that's why even when the economy started to improve and jobs came back, the home ownership rate continued to fall to the point where the wealth gap in this country between the top 0.1% of Americans and the bottom 90% is greater than it's been in more than 100 years.
You write that it didn't necessarily have to be that way in the Obama years. There were people making the case that there should be investments made in community redevelopment. There were, at least on paper, requirements that some of these banks negotiate, try to help people negotiate their way out of foreclosure. A lot of opportunities there that you write weren't followed through on. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, that was the most shocking thing that I found, actually, writing the whole book, was the extent to which good people came forward with good ideas and were just summarily ignored throughout this whole decade. I write about how in 2008, former members of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, former advisors to President Reagan, members of the conservative American Enterprise Institute, you know, so not pinkos, like bipartisan across the board, went to Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, you know, who controlled Congress at that time, and said to them, you know, what happened during the Great Depression, which was far worse than what we're experiencing now, was that the government, instead of bailing out the banks, made a gigantic investment in the American people. And President Roosevelt founded this bank called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. It invented the long-term fixed rate mortgage. Before that, there was no such thing. People were given these short-term interest-only loans with balloon payments at the end. But Roosevelt said, we should have a bank that offers, you know, good, solid financial products that people can actually pay back. And they refinanced one out of every five homes in urban America. They saved 1 million homes. And then when the economy started to get better, they took the homes they did have to foreclose on because it was a bank, and they sold them off to other families individually, financing those purchases. And this was brought up as an option at the time of the crash. And I asked the people who brought this up, I said, well, tell me about the debate. Tell me about the lobbying effort against this. And they said that it never even got that far, that these ideas were laughed out by the Democratic leaders when they were brought up, and they didn't even get far enough to be lobbied against. So you know, this homeowners loan corporation, this government bank, we're told we can't afford this. It made money for the taxpayers, because when you bet on the American people, guess what? They pay back their loans with interest. After World War II, we had the GI Bill. 4 million American veterans were able to buy homes. We broke even on that. So we have the money. We have the ability to build a just and fair society with equal opportunity for everyone, which is the American dream. But instead, what we've done is go down this road of shoveling lots and lots of money at a very small group of people.
We're talking to Aaron Glantz of Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. His new book is called Home Wreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of the homes and demolished the American dream.
And we want to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the fallout and the profit from the housing crisis? Were you foreclosed on during that time? What happened? And what does owning a home mean to you or maybe your kids today? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we continue the conversation with author and investigative reporter Aaron Glantz. We're talking about the 2008 housing market crash and the people who made money in its aftermath.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have about the current state of the housing market and where it's heading? What do you think of the government response to foreclosures back in the Great Recession? Is this a story that affected you personally as a homeowner or somebody who couldn't be a homeowner after that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We just talked about the Obama administration's role here. You touched on now the people who surround President Trump. Can you talk more about who emerged out of this class you call Aaron Homewreckers and into Donald Trump's inner circle?
Yeah, well, we mentioned Steve Mnuchin, who, you know, has been called the foreclosure king for foreclosing on more than 100,000 families and 23,000 seniors. He becomes the Treasury Secretary after, you know, after he was Donald Trump's campaign finance chair. We talk about Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who also bought a failed bank in Florida and received his group more than $1 billion in government subsidies as he foreclosed. We talk about the president's best friend, Tom Barrack, who used the financial crisis to amass a real estate empire of more than 30,000 homes. And Steve Schwarzman, the co-founder of Blackstone, who now is at the top of an empire owning more than 80,000 homes across more than a dozen states. And the final home wrecker that I like to mention is Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, the biggest bank in America. This is a bank that has dramatically scaled back its lending to individual families in the decade after the bust, not only during the bust itself, but reducing its lending even during the economic recovery. This same bank is extending billions in credit to corporate landlords like Schwarzman and Barrack. If you go to some individual homes in places like Chicago or Los Angeles or Houston or Atlanta, you will find 1,500 square foot homes, 2,000 square foot homes, 800 square foot homes that have liens on them of almost $1 billion. And that's because these Wall Street landlords are able to bundle all these homes together and take out enormous amounts of debt that their tenants rather are paying off with increasing rent. And that is all made possible by the financing of big banks like Chase.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in New Richmond. Nick, hi.
Hi. Hey, I think education plays a part in what happened. I bought a foreclosed house in that time period where, so I think education against predatory, I don't know if I want to call them a home wrecker because I do believe in capitalism. But as far as when I went to the bank, they told me I qualified for a $325,000 house. And I said, man, you're crazy. I can't afford a $325,000 house. they told me, well, you qualify. Well, I set my standard at $150,000 house, and that's what I set out to do, where if there's a collapse in the markets, I'm not going to lose my house.
But Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And Aaron, a lot of people point toward, okay, well, did a lot of individuals get greedy and take banks up on their free credit at the time?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the caller is exactly right. What I'm just trying to do is move the debate forward a little bit, right? Whatever you think of those foreclosures themselves, if we lived in kind of a just capitalistic society where there was equal opportunity for everyone, then you might have some losses by people who are greedy, and then you might have winners who are other family members or other, you know, small people like me. I bought a house during the Great Recession. It sounds like the caller also was able to benefit. But in the main, what we've seen is a huge transfer of wealth from millions of individual families to a very small group of corporate landlords. We now have 3 million homes and 15 million apartments in this country that are controlled by LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies, right? That is new. We didn't have that before. And so that is why, I wrote this book, Homewreckers.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Laura with us in Marshfield. Laura, hi.
Hello. Back in 04 and 05, I, as a single person, had bought myself a house, and I had it for 8 years when I got behind by 1 month. And I was making my payments, but they were 1 month late. And after 3 months, the bank foreclosed on me. I had $70,000 in equity that I lost. I don't know. Now it's how many years later, and I'm paying $600 in rent, and I just can't get back on my feet to even get back into a house because no lender will look at me now.
Laura, thank you so much for that call. Laura, not alone, Aaron. A lot of people found themselves on foreclosure, in some cases, after a brief setback of a month or two.
Yeah, I mean, the famous case is Steve Mnuchin foreclosed on a 90-year-old woman. His bank foreclosed on a 90-year-old woman in Florida who owed 27 cents. That happened, right? The incentives were all wrong. And the reason the incentives were all wrong was because the banks were given this gigantic bailout, and then they were told to help people. But even if they didn't help people, even if they revved up their foreclosure machine, there was no one watching the store. And the really important thing from your caller is that here we are more than a decade later, and she is still renting. Right, she has been unable to get back into the homeownership situation. And, you know, we live in a country where the average homeowner is worth $200,000 and the average renter is worth $2,000. And that's because most of your listeners, like me, spend most of their income every month on essentials like food, transportation, clothing, health insurance premiums. And all of the money that I just mentioned, as soon as you spend that health insurance premium, it's gone. It's never coming back. The only way for people to spend money and save money at the same time is through their mortgage payment. And if you pay for housing and it's a mortgage payment, then you can be building equity for your family. And if it is a rental payment, then you're going to be building wealth for your landlord. It's just that simple. And the concern now is with these homewreckers in charge, it's going to be harder and harder for people to get back into home ownership again.
Laura, thanks for the call. We're talking to Aaron Glantz, author of the new book, Home Wreckers. Back to your calls. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. I have two questions, one looking back, one looking forward. The one looking back, there was a movie a few years ago about people who were making money by betting that these mortgages were going to fail, some sort of, I don't know, insurance. I still don't understand how that whole movie worked and how people made money off of it. And then the second one is, with the rise in student debt, who's going to be around to buy these houses with people's credit scores not doing so great because a lot of us aren't paying our student loans like we should?
Tim, thanks for the call. I think he's talking about The Big Short there, Aaron, and I think in 3 minutes we're not going to explain credit default swaps successfully. So let's focus on his second question. Go ahead.
Oh, I just one thing I wanted to say about The Big Short is I agree that we're not going to have time to get into it too much. But just remember that these people that I'm writing out, they're the people who came in after that whole story, mm-hmm. right? They're the people who profited off of the next thing after the foreclosures had already happened and the market had already crashed. And I do think that sometimes we are so traumatized and so confused by what happened in 2007 and 2008 that we forget that it's now 2019 and a full decade has passed. And that's what my book is about.
Right. And Tim asking about student debt, who's going to buy these houses? In many cases, Aaron, it sounds like these companies, often shell companies that own these houses, aren't selling. They're renting them now, right?
Right. They're renting them out. So a lot of this property is being taken off the market for people to buy. It's being held by shell companies owned by big Wall Street firms. And then what you have is you have people dealing with, you know, very significant crippling student debt. And at the same time, their rent continues to go up, which makes it even harder for folks to save for a down payment, right? Because as I mentioned, these homes are being leveraged. These companies are taking out debt against these homes, and then they're having the tenants pay off that debt. So instead of you paying off your mortgage and gaining equity, you are paying off the debt of your corporate landlord. But, you know, be that as it may, all these problems are solvable. You know, I talked earlier about how during the Great Depression, the government made a big investment in home ownership, saved the economy and made money, right? So, it doesn't need to be all gloom and doom. We just need to take a step back and know that there is another way.
Good place to leave it, Aaron. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Talk to him about the way a number of people made money off the housing crisis. He tells that story in his new book. It's called Home Wreckers.
Coming up after the news, we're talking about Wisconsin's expungement system for criminal records. That's as state lawmakers consider legislation that could make more people eligible. I'm Keeley Boltina.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, it's peak season for haunted houses, horror movies, and spending time with things that creep us out. We'll talk with an environmental psychologist about the reasons those dark corners and creepy hallways are so scary.
Now, when Governor Evers took office this year, one of the first things he said he wanted to take action on was a reform of the state's marijuana laws.
That includes legalizing medical marijuana, but it also extends to changes that help people who already have low-level marijuana convictions on their records.
That would include changes to the state's expungement system. Now, a bipartisan bill on the topic has passed the state assembly and is waiting to be heard in the state Senate.
Natalie Yar is a graduate student at UW-Madison School of Journalism and is joining the staff of the Cap Times next month. Her latest piece for WisconsinWatch.org is about the effects of low-level marijuana convictions and the changes considered at the Capitol. Natalie, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some real-world examples, helping people understand what are the low-level marijuana convictions that we're talking about. What does that look like?
So, for example, when Governor Evers was talking about decriminalizing some recreational marijuana use, he was using the benchmark of, I believe, 25 grams. But the types of convictions that could be affected by this bill that's going to be going to the Senate now, it's a much broader set of things because it's an expungement bill that's not restricted to marijuana exclusively that could affect a whole wider set of nonviolent misdemeanors and felonies.
And we'll talk more about the push for expungement in just a couple of minutes. But what can these low-level marijuana crimes do to a person's life? What kind of trajectory can happen after a conviction?
Yes. So having a criminal record, and we know that around 1.4 million Wisconsinites have some sort of a criminal record, not exclusively marijuana, just criminal record in general, can have all sorts of implications for decades, often for the rest of one's life, when it comes to, for example, seeking employment, seeking professional licensure to enter a new occupation, to find housing, to receive public benefits. And in a state like Wisconsin, it's extremely easy for an employer, a landlord, anyone really to look up another person and see their criminal record through a system, an online system called CCAP that's completely free to access. So that kind of raises the stakes on what's sitting on a person's record and how that can impact them.
But government transparency advocates will say that's good, yep, that we have access to that information. It should
absolutely
be public knowledge.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so that does that change? How does that factor into, I guess, to this discussion?
That's very much at the heart of this discussion. This bill that is, before the legislature is talking about increasing the opportunities for people to remove certain things from their records. And transparency advocates would absolutely say, hey, we're very worried about that. Wisconsin is kind of famous for its open government approaches. And so it's no coincidence that we have very easy access to this kind of information. But then the people who are advocating for this kind of change and advocating for more opportunities for individuals to clear some of these things from at least their more public-facing record would say, it's a balancing act, and that at some point the opportunity for people to be able to move ahead with their lives and kind of start over in some ways might be worth that somewhat reduced transparency.
In researching this, you met a man named Brian Britt. Introduce us to him.
Yeah. So I met Brian Britt. He's 42. Met him at an expungement clinic that was being held at the Urban League of Greater Madison. He was there. There were about 20 people at this event who were looking to speak to lawyers who were volunteering their time, and they wanted to find out whether they might be able to remove things from their criminal records. He had two convictions. He had more convictions, but he had two convictions that he wanted to try to get off of his record that he really felt were holding him back. And they were both a marijuana charge and a gun charge from about 20 years before. And he found that they were impacting him in lots of ways. He wanted to try to remove them from his record. He unfortunately found that he wasn't going to be able to under current law.
But you found that he was struggling to get rental space for his new business, and that he also he had to kind of get an exception from school when he was going to school in cosmetology.
Yes. So Brian Britt is now a barber. He has a cosmetology license. He owns Inspire Barber and Beauty Salon on the east side of Madison. And he spent about a year trying to find a rental space. Or that's what he says. He says it took around a year for him to find a landlord that would rent him a space for his business. And he says it took quite a while for him to figure out why he kept getting rejected, and that at some point he learned that landlords were looking him up in the CCAP system, and then that they told him, we believe because of your background that drugs are going to be sold at this location. And he finally, after about a year, found a landlord who would rent him a space in a strip mall off Cottage Grove Road, and that's where he has his business now.
Natalie Yar is the author of two recent pieces for Wisconsin Watch about the effects of low-level marijuana convictions. Let's talk about expungement now. What's the process in Wisconsin, and what are we trying to change?
Yeah. So in Wisconsin right now, Wisconsin's expungement law, and again, this would just be the law governing which things a person can get removed from their record, or at least removed from their publicly available record. Wisconsin's law has been called by the Wisconsin Policy Forum atypical, as in not typical, because it's kind of unusually restrictive. And this may well go along with Wisconsin's, history of open government, with transparency. Wisconsin doesn't give a whole lot of opportunities for people to take things off of their record. And so specifically, in Wisconsin, you can only get something removed from your record. You can only get a conviction removed from your record if you were under 25 at the time that the crime or the alleged crime happened, and if a judge made that decision at the time of sentencing, and also only in specific types of crimes. And so this means that most people who have a conviction on their record, and if they were 25 or older at that time just are not eligible. And that's where some legislators, there's now a bipartisan bill that's going to soon be before the Senate, has already been approved in the Assembly to potentially expand this, to remove the age limit and to allow these decisions to be made at other times besides just at sentencing.
It sounds like part of the problem is that we used to punish marijuana severely, and now attitudes about this have changed some, and but people who were punished harshly before are facing repercussions from those, you know, kind of now changed attitudes. Is that fair?
That is certainly one aspect of this issue. So this expungement, this bill to change the expungement law would have implications far beyond only marijuana, but that marijuana convictions are certainly one part of this. So this would also impact if you had a crime that was completely unrelated to marijuana. You could also get that expunged potentially if the opportunities were expanded. But people with marijuana convictions, we know that marijuana convictions in the state of Wisconsin are among the most commonly expunged. So for the people who can get expungements, those who are under 25 at the time of the crime, I don't have the number in front of me right now, but some of the most common crimes that they are getting expunged are marijuana crimes. So we can only imagine, you know, if that was open to an older demographic also, marijuana crimes would probably be could easily be a large fraction of these crimes. And yes, attitudes certainly have shifted on marijuana. We know that Wisconsin is not legalizing yet, but we also know that many jurisdictions have voted in referendums in favor of legalization or decriminalization, and that at points in the past, for example, in the 90s, some marijuana crimes were punished even more heavily. Some people still have felonies for things that would now be misdemeanors. So the lawyers I spoke to did say, you know, if there were a change in this, it could potentially, you know, relieve a lot of people of felony convictions. Of course, they're advocating for their clients who they want to give another opportunity to.
Sure. But across Wisconsin, it could mean some real change in people's lives.
Yes. The Wisconsin Policy Forum estimates that if this bill were to pass, they say at least 80,000 more cases could be eligible for expungement.
Natalie, thank you for coming in today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Natalie Yar, a graduate student at UW-Madison School of Journalism. And she's with us today to talk about her two recent pieces for Wisconsin Watch, looking at the effects of low-level marijuana convictions and changes lawmakers are considering to the state's expungement system.
Coming up, we'll dig into the psychology of why spooky forests or old empty houses can be so creepy and why we seek them out anyway. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. The leader of the Islamic State killed himself in the midst of a raid by American forces this weekend. We look at what his death means for the war against ISIS still ahead.
First, we're just a few days out from Halloween, meaning some of us might be going to our local haunted house or watching our favorite creepy movies.
Places like that old abandoned house or dark forest, they're just plain scary. But what exactly makes us so uneasy?
Our next guest says the answer lies in our evolution, and that's part of the reason we seek them out anyway.
Frank McAndrew is a professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois. There, he specializes in environmental psychology and studying creepiness. I talked with him earlier today. Frank, let's start in the woods at night. Tell us what we can learn from that kind of experience. Take us there.
Well, the woods at night was always a bad place for human beings. And you can all the way go back to the Grimm's fairy tales with Hansel and Gretel and a variety of other stories. We always wanted to impress on our children why you don't go there. And actually, one of the theories about why we sleep is that it was adaptive just because it kept us out of trouble at night. When we couldn't see what was going on and there were a lot of predators around. So we don't like dark places where we can get lost, like the woods.
Gotcha. And there are a lot of creepy sounds that happen in the woods. How does that relate to the behaviors that we've developed as human beings?
Well, yes, there are a lot of noises. Some of them are animal noises. Some of them are vegetation rustling. And all of these can be signals that there's some that we're not alone there. And right away, it was adaptive for us to always err on the side of assuming that it was something dangerous. Because if you get very cautious and attentive with rustling bushes and it turns out that the wind is just blowing where there's a rabbit running around, well, you haven't really lost anything. But if you're walking through the woods and the bushes are rustling and you decide, it's probably just a rabbit, and then it's not, the cost of that can be pretty high. So we're the descendants of cowards, basically, people who always assumed the worst.
That seems really relatable. I understand why something that snaps a branch in the dark woods nearby would be concerning to me. It poses a threat, but creepy houses or just different spaces, they're not alive. They don't pose that immediate threat. So what's happening there when it comes to space?
Well, creepy houses didn't exist when we were evolving. So our caveman brains respond to any environment as if it's a natural environment. And so when we're walking around in a dark house, the equivalent of the snapping branch, the creaky stairs, the rustling curtains, all of those things press the same buttons in our brain that put us on our guard. And we don't like places that we don't feel protected in. We really like places where we feel like we can see what's going on and there's not a lot of hiding places for bad things. We don't like places where we can't see what's going on and there are a lot of hiding places for bad things. The kinds of places we like have been described as a womb with a view, sort of a warm, protective place that we can look out of, but we feel like others can't see us. They're sometimes called places that we can see without being seen or eat without being eaten.
And you have really great examples of this. You talk about children playing in boxes, but you also mention how we like to sit at restaurants.
Sure. I mean, if you're like most people, when you walk into a restaurant and they give you a choice, would you like a cozy corner booth or do you want to sit right out there in the open at a table where you're surrounded by people on all sides? They don't actually say it that way, of course, but your impression of the place is exactly that way. You always choose the cozy, secluded, comfortable place because that's a vestige of our comfort in those kinds of areas. And yeah, kids love building forts, playing in places where they feel hidden. And it's all part of the reason we don't like haunted houses where we feel exposed and there are eyes in the paintings following us around and we can't see around the next corner.
Frank McAndrew is a professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois, where he specializes in environmental psychology. We're talking about how some spaces just seem creepy. Frank, talk to us about the idea of prospect and refuge being key to what makes a place feel safe or feel scary.
Yes, prospect and refuge are two of the fundamental psychological features of places. Prospect means you have the experience of feeling like you can survey your surroundings. You can see what's near you and what isn't. You can spot something that might be approaching you. Refuge, on the other hand, gives you the sense of being protected or enclosed. So we like places that are high in prospect and high in refuge for us because that enables us to detect any threat that might be approaching us and also feel like whatever it is that's threatening us can't see us. And there have been studies that have demonstrated that, in fact, when people are judging environments as being safe or not safe, the combination of prospect and refuge is the key ingredient to determine whether people feel safe there.
So let's draw the line then between prospect and refuge as we experience it in normal life and when we experience it in something like a haunted house. How do those two connect?
Well, the haunted house is designed intentionally to creep us out. So it has a floor plan that's confusing. It's dark. There are lots of hidden secret spaces, passageways and closets and attics and basements. And so it's sort of like our worst nightmare on steroids. And houses that are thought to be haunted houses are almost always old. And because they're old, that means that they have a history where things might have happened there. And they're not very legible. It's hard to see from one part of the house to the other. You don't usually see haunted houses represented in movies as these sort of modern open floor plan houses. You usually have to go through dark hallways and up and down creaky stairs. That all adds to the effect.
And it sounds like we're back to the idea that it's not necessarily the threat that scares us, but the fact that we can't tell whether a threat exists.
That's right. I like to make a distinction between being scared and being creeped out. When you're scared, you have identified the danger and you know what you're facing, and you usually know what you have to do to escape. So if you're being chased by a bear or the house is on fire or something like that, that's terrifying and it's scary. But it's different than being creeped out. Creeped out means you're not sure that there is something to worry about. And so you're walking around constantly on your guard, feeling very uneasy, wallowing in discomfort, because it could be nothing or it could be something. And it's the uncertainty that just drives you crazy. And you'd feel silly, like screaming and running out of a house if there's nothing to be afraid of. But on the other hand, if you should be screaming and running out of the house, you better get started. And so you're left kind of paralyzed, not knowing what to do.
Right. And sometimes the sound of an abandoned place or an old building can contribute to that.
Absolutely. The sound of what's called the hum, the constant sort of moan of wind going through the house. And you may not even register it as a sound. It's more of a feeling. But also, because you can't tell if you're alone in there or not, any sound that you do hear, that creak upstairs or a door that sounds like it's closing, if you believe in monsters and ghosts and things that might be in haunted houses, you immediately start racing through your attention capacity, trying to determine if that's the thing that's there. You're going to be less creeped out if you don't believe in those things.
So some of it is instinctual and some of it is just how, what I believe.
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't believe that something is possible, you're not going to worry about it. So if you do believe in ghosts, you're going to be more creeped out than the person that doesn't believe in ghosts when you're hearing and seeing the very same things.
Frank, we have to get to the why here. If it feels yucky, if it feels creepy, why do we keep going back to the movie theater when there's something scary on the screen?
Well, why indeed? When you think about it, we pay a lot of money to expose ourselves to things we'd avoid like the plague in real life. But I do think there's a method to the madness. I think we're programmed to want to be prepared for future calamities. And in the safety of a movie theater, you can watch other people dealing with serial killers and ghosts and other paranormal things. And you find yourself almost wanting to give them advice, you know, don't go into that room. No, don't open that door. And by seeing what happens to them as a result of what they do, we learn strategies, what works and what doesn't work, so that if you are faced with a serial killer or a ghost, maybe you'll be better prepared for it. I think we're interested in stories about people who have survived incredible ordeals like being lost in the wilderness for 2 weeks or surviving a shark attack for the very same reasons. We're fascinated by these stories, and we don't really consciously know why, but I think what's really going on is we're picking up valuable information. What if this happened to us? What would we do?
Okay, I can see that, but then what's our excuse for going to a haunted house?
Well, the haunted house, I think, gives you feedback about yourself. And I'm not saying you consciously go in there saying, well, I'm really going to learn something about myself here. You go in there because there's this impulse that's enjoyable and exciting, and you're a little bit on edge. But by finding out how you respond to different types of stimuli, by finding out what scares you and what doesn't, and how you handle a situation like that, knowledge about yourself can also be very valuable in future times of danger and calamity. And so we're learning something else that we might be able to use later on.
Frank, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Frank McAndrew is a professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois. He talked with us about why some spaces, like haunted houses or dark forests, make us so uneasy.
You can let us know what you think about creepy places. Do you make it a point to go to your local haunted house this time of year? What's your favorite part of it? What do you like about being scared? Do you have a favorite spooky place in Wisconsin? You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you ever have trouble coming up with a creative Halloween costume idea? I do. That's why I gave up on it.
Oh, and if you're like Rob, this might give you hope. There's an annual Halloween contest in Japan to come up with the most boring, most mundane costume possible.
As reported on the website Kotaku, the event has been running for about 5 years now. It was started by people who are fed up with over-the-top Halloween costumes and all the effort that went into them. We were looking at the list, some of the ideas I thought were pretty cool. And some people actually put effort into them. So what were some of the things we saw there?
I mean, I did like the person taking a photo of their meal. I feel
right.
like
That's
I know.
Costume.
Right. That is the costume.
I am going as a person taking a photo of my meal.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Someone about to win Old Maid was holding right. up just one card. And like, you know, the answer, right? Like,
uh-huh.
that's the person who's going to go out.
Uh-huh.
And you can't, you just have to keep playing and it's inevitable.
My vote went to someone who went as a person who would get mistaken as store staff at an eyeglasses shop. Because, I mean, the shirt that he selected was right. The glasses, like, yeah, if you worked at the glasses store, you'd have a pretty cool pair of glasses.
But Rob, he's just wearing a polo with some glasses on his face.
And that's
like,
what I love about this.
I
am inspired. I think I may adopt this costume. Watch for my costume on Thursday.
I'll check it
See
out.
See if you can figure it out.
I'll try really hard.
I haven't thought of it yet. But it's going to be mundane and boring. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.